Welcome to another episode of the Wine Scholar Guild podcast. I'm Valerie Caruso, a French wine scholar and podcast host. And today I have the pleasure of introducing not only one, but two award-winning authors. You may remember Decanter Magazine's Andrew Jefford, a feature masterclass and webinar presenter. Today he will be breaking down Bordeaux with Decanter Magazine's Jane Anson. Jane is also the author of Wine Revolution and Bordeaux Legends, the 1855 First Growth Wines, and will be leading the Master Level Bordeaux Seminar for the Wine Scholar Guild. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is great. And Jane, before we get into it, could you tell us just a little bit about yourself and your relationship to Bordeaux in particular?
Sure. Well, I am British. I've been living in Bordeaux since 2003. I moved here from London, and I am now a colleague of Andrew's at Decanter Magazine. And I really specialize in writing about the history of the region, and I taste the Bordeaux wines every year for Decanter for the Imprimeur.
Fantastic. Jane, look, there's so much to talk about with Bordeaux that it's always really hard to know where to start. So why don't we do what most visitors to the region do? And that's head straight up to the Médoc, of course, and its four classic appellations: Margaux, Saint-Julien, Pauillac, Saint-Estèphe. Of course, when you get to the Médoc physically in person, you realise that it's way bigger than that. So why is it that those four names stand out in quality terms?
So it's a great question. When you look at the size of the Médoc, it is about 100 kilometres from north to south. It has about 40,000 hectares of vines in there. 40,000 hectares in total. Not all of those are vines, but it has about 40,000 hectares of land. And it is kind of crazy. There are eight appellations within the Médoc. And yet, you're quite right, those four names stand out always as being the most sought after, the ones that people pay the most for. And it can seem a little odd. So I'm going to break it down into two main reasons. And it's all to do with geology and terroir and water. These are the things that make a difference in Bordeaux. So if you look at the river, the Garonne River, which goes from the center of Bordeaux up to the sea, up to the Atlantic Ocean, those four appellations that you're talking about line the river. They are the closest to the river. And it's very easy for us to look now back into history and say, well, that was the way that we got the wines out to market. They went from Bordeaux Centre right up to the Atlantic Ocean. So is it because these were simply the appellations that were closest to ports that could load their wines onto the ships and go off, and therefore they had an advantage? But that's actually not the case, for one good reason, which is that they weren't allowed to sell their wines directly from their own ports and head out to the UK or to whichever markets they were going to. In fact, they had to go back down into the city of Bordeaux and then be shipped from the Quai de Chartres. So we can't say that is the reason that those four appellations are the best known. What we need to look at instead is what it means being close to the river. One of the things, if you look at the temperature of the Médoc, is that the closer you are to that river, the better you are in terms of a clement climate. You have the air moving from this large body of water, which goes up to 2 kilometres wide at one point. This is almost like a small, it's not really an inland sea, but it's certainly a significant amount of water. And as you're closer to that, you have less frost risk. We saw that in 2017. The further you get away from that river, the more you have potential problems of colder nights, colder mornings and frost. And also the way that the Médoc is laid out is it's a series of gravel terraces. And the best of those gravel terraces are closest to the river. And by best, I mean biggest gravels. This is an area which is, as we say, we've got the water. It's not a warm area. It needs to have hot soils for the grapes to get ripe enough. And the bigger the gravel, the riper the grapes get. So as you go closer to the river, the soils get bigger. I'm going to talk about two other appellations in the center of the Médoc, which are called Moulis and Listrac. They're both great appellations. There are some beautiful gravels there, but they tend to have more clay and more sand, particularly Listrac. There's a kind of beautiful black sand, which can give wonderful, fragrant, really delicious wines, but they're not as powerful as the ones are, particularly from Pauillac and Saint-Estèphe and Saint-Julien. So you have this kind of, they kind of play catch up in terms of their structure and how they taste and how they age. although there are some very, very good wines in Mouly and Lystrac. And one final thing before we leave the Medoc, you're quite right, Andrew, you can talk about these things forever, is that we have two big generic appellations in the Medoc called Haut Médoc and Médoc. Now, all of the communal, all of the village appellations with the famous names are within the boundaries of the Haut Médoc. And there is a big difference between Haut Médoc and Médoc because most of the gravel, most of the good terroir is in the Haut Médoc. As you head up to the Médoc itself, you get for a start, the peninsula has become narrower. It's become much narrower once you get to the Médoc, which is the kind of northerly section of the peninsula. And what that means is you have a lot more of a influence of the ocean and of the estuary, so you have a cooler climate. You have soils which are not as gravelly, they're more sandy, they're more clay. So what that means is Merlot does better in the Médoc than in the Haut Médoc. And again, that will have an influence on what the wines will taste like, how long they will age, how structured they are. So there is a very good reason why those four appellations, to answer, come back to your question, why those four appellations do have a kind of leg up in terms of renown.
Jane, that's a fantastically comprehensive introduction to the Médoc. Really terrific stuff, I think. I learned a lot from that. Brilliant. So now let's switch to the right bank. Now, with the right bank, you've got this one enormous appellation, Saint-Emilion. And often people tend to look at it and say, wait a minute, this doesn't really make much sense in terroir terms. It's far too big. You've got all these different sectors and zones within it. Well, what's your opinion? Is it too big? Should it be chopped up into different appellations?
So that is one of the questions which really makes me scratch my head as well for the years of living here. Saint-Emilion can be so frustrating because it's an appellation where one of the very few appellations in Bordeaux where they actually lay out their wines by terroir. They tell you, you know, these are the limestone bits, these are the clay bits, these are the gravel bits, because that's how their classification is. It's the only classification in Bordeaux which does specifically link what the types of soil are like to where they get the classification. So at one level, we can think, oh, great, finally, we're in a part of Bordeaux which makes sense. But as you say, they don't draw that distinction for the normal, you know, the outside observer. So just by seeing the name Saint-Emilion on a label, you don't necessarily know what that soil difference is. And then you have the problem. Okay, so we could split it up, but already we've got AOC Saint-Emilion, AOC Saint-Emilion Grand Cru, AOC Saint-Emilion Grand Cru Classé, and then we have all the satellites. So we've got Puy-Séguin, we've got Saint-Georges, we've got Lussac, we've got Montagne. So I don't think the answer probably is adding more appellations. But I wonder if there is a more sensible way of drawing the distinction between these different parts. There's a problem for me. One of the worst named appellations in the whole of France is Saint-Emilion Grand Cru, because it sounds like it's a quality thing. Grand Cru, we're used to that in Burgundy, is it being the top of the quality tree. And that's not the case here. It is simply the geographic area is exactly the same as AOC Saint-Emilion, but it's to do with aging of the wines. There is lower yields. There are certain things that do imply that it's better quality, but it's not as simple as Grand Cru is in, for example, Burgundy, where it's absolutely linked to the quality of the wine. So Saint-Emilion for me is frustrating, but actually a really exciting appellation because it does have these distinct terroir types, and they do their best to recognise the best parts of it and give them these top qualifications of a Premier Grand Cru or Grand Cru Classé.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I've always loved Saint-Emilion myself. It's a fantastic appellation to discover, and you can get some great value there. But I think it's an appellation where you really have to do a little bit more work yourself as a consumer than you would in other places. Certainly the Médoc, it's kind of handed to you on a plate, really, with the classification system. And then, of course, we come to Little Pomerol, a much, much smaller appellation, but very, very select. Often people have a real soft spot for Pomerol, and I have to confess I'm one of those. And they, of course, have no classifications whatsoever, nothing at all. Is that a good idea or is it a bad idea? What do you think?
I love the thought that there's Pomerol and Saint-Emilion right next to each other, and they could not have more opposite approaches and ideas to how they get their wines out to the consumer. So you have the infighting in Saint-Emilion you know, a lot of the politics of who gets what. And this classification is redone every 10 years. So there's constantly a slight tension among everybody of who's going to be promoted, who's going to be demoted. Remember, over on the left bank, you don't get demoted. You're 1855 or you're not. And that stays as it is. In Pessac-Léognan, you're a Grand Cru Classé de Grave or you're not. It stays that way. Saint-Emilion, you have this kind of roller coaster every 10 years. What's going to happen? And right next to it, there's Pomerol sitting pretty, doesn't do anything. It just lets the market say who is the best, who is not. Not the best, that's unfair, but who are, what are consumers willing to pay more for? Obviously, we have Petrus right at the top. We have Le Pan, we have La Fleur. But there's nothing to tell consumers that they're the best other than, you know, the experience of drinking them and the price and the buzz that's created around them. So for me, I agree with you, absolutely. There is something wonderful and magic about Pomerol. And other than those big names, you're not led to the ones you love. You get to discover them yourself, because it's not because they're a fifth growth or a third growth. It's because you drink them, you discover them, and you fall in love with them.
And it really is a tiny little place. And yet, to me, the astonishing thing is when you actually go there and root around, you'll see these very, very well-known names. But then right next door to some of the well-known names, you'll see a tiny property that you've never heard of, completely obscure. So there's still potential. You can still find exciting things in Pomerol. And for me, in such a small area, that's just amazing. Anyway, now let's move on to, well, I'm not going to call them the minor appellations because that's vaguely insulting. But there are lots and lots of other appellations in Bordeaux, aren't there? Scattered all around the main areas we've talked about so far. And I always feel a bit sorry for the people who are really trying hard in those places, because somehow, no matter how hard they try, they're never really taken quite as seriously as the properties are in the classic areas. And yet there's some fantastic value to be found there. Why don't you just pick us very briefly the Jane Anson route through some of those minor appellations, mentioning some of the things you're fondest of?
Absolutely. And in fact, picking up on something you said about Pomerol, there are absolutely a ton of small estates that, me too, even living here 15 years, traveling around the vineyards all the time, I still am constantly coming across estates, even in Pomerol, that I think, oh, I haven't been there, or I don't know who owns that, or you know, there's something I don't know, because there are 6,500 properties in Bordeaux. You know, with the best will in the world, you're never going to know all of them. And that's part of the joy of this region. But I think we can probably say in Pomerol that most of the truly great terroirs have been found. They probably have been, there's still some reworking. Look at La Pointe. La Pointe is a chateau which, over the last 5 years, really, they've done huge amounts of work on drainage, on bringing its terroir back. But I think we can say they pretty much have been identified. The beauty, once you head out of the major, say there are eight major appellation names in Bordeaux, once you head out of there, there are so many discoveries, because there can be fantastic soil types, fantastic south-facing slopes, all of these things. And actually what it takes there is families who care, who love their wines and who are prepared to invest. And that is, as you say, there's this whole huge potential for discovery there. And there are 65 different appellations in Bordeaux. I'm definitely not going to go through them all. Of those 65 appellations, we're going from around 140 meters of altitude at the highest down to about really 12 to 14 meters of altitude at the lowest. And you've got both sides of the river, left bank, right bank. I think for me, if I'm going to pick out a couple, it's the ones which historically have been recognized and have made wonderful wines, but that have maybe been forgotten about. So Fronzac would be one for me that I would really pick out as being a wonderful appellation to get to know. Fronzac is on the right bank. It's close to Saint-Emilion and to Pomerol, a little bit higher in elevation, certainly than Pomerol, with a lot of the same limestone soils that you have in Saint-Emilion. And in the 19th century, it was incredibly well known. People paid a lot of money, just as much as they would do for Saint-Emilion. But it has fallen out of favor. It's not so well known. You've had a couple of kind of, I guess, PR blows, like Moex, who is a very famous name in Pomerol, who sold all of his Fronzac estates because he felt that it wasn't really making money from them. And so, you know, they struggled with really getting an identity. But really see over the last 5 to 10 years, Fronzac coming roaring back. I think it's really helped the slightly cooler soils there. So maybe the tannins have been a little rustic historically, but with the warming cycle that we have, the shorter growing seasons, you're finding the tannins there are getting much softer, much silkier. There's some really wonderful wines to discover there. Another place is Lalonde de Pomerol, so right next to Pomerol. As the prices have gone up in terms of buying hectares of vines in Bordeaux, you find that a lot of the younger producers or the children of the more famous established families will edge out around the big appellations that their parents maybe made their fortune in. So Lalonde de Pomerol has got a lot of links with Pomerol, obviously, but a lot of younger producers who are doing exciting things. So I would definitely suggest there. And Castillon, another right bank, an appellation which used to be hugely renowned but lost some of its fame and is again edging back. So those would be three on the right bank that I would mention. And we haven't talked about probably my favourite appellation, which is Pessac-Léognan. Pessac-Léognan is no longer by any stretch of the imagination a small appellation, but it's only 30 years old. It's possibly the most, you know, certainly the most recent creation in Bordeaux, must be one of the most recent in France. It's a wonderful appellation because it has fantastic whites as well as fantastic red wines. And it's a place which I definitely hold very close to my heart.
Brilliant. Well, that's a great roundup. I absolutely agree with you about Fronzac and Lalonde de Pomerol. Those are two appellations that I try and hunt down for value myself. Great potential in both of those. And you mentioned Pessac-Léognan, which is nice because it would be good just to talk a little bit about Bordeaux's dry white wine. That's something that, obviously, if you're in the region, you will always have a chance to taste. The great collectors of Bordeaux red wine sometimes overlook a bit. Anyway, Jane, is it still Pessac-Léognan that's kind of ruling the roost as far as dry white wine goes, or are there some new areas beginning to come on stream? I know that people try very hard with dry white wine up in the Médoc nowadays.
That's right. There are what they like to call icon whites up in the Médoc because a lot of the big guys like Mouton, Rothschild and Margaux have small production of white wines, which has drawn attention to that production there. In fact, one of the things I really find fascinating about white Bordeaux is that, as you say, today it's not really well recognized. People kind of overlook it, but you don't have to head back very far in history to realize that white wine was incredibly important in Bordeaux. Right back in 1969, so not that long ago, white wines were 59% of all the declared harvest in Bordeaux. And it wasn't until, I think, 1973, certainly the early 70s, when red wine overtook white. Some of the appellations that I mentioned, Castillon used to be better known for its whites than its reds. And in fact, its whites sold for much higher prices than its reds until about the 1950s. Over on the left bank, we have the little appellation of Listrac Médoc, up in the Médoc. Again, was very famous for its white wines, certainly in the 19th century and early 20th century. And you're starting to see this kind of excitement happening about white wines again. Maybe because I'm imagining, because there's so little of it now compared to the reds, the people who make it care about it. They know that they have a market for it now because they're not competing against everybody else in Bordeaux. I often hear from sommeliers who say that, weirdly, white Bordeaux is becoming one of their easiest sells for them in restaurants in New York and in places like that, because it's a discovery. And the sommeliers like to feel like they're discovering something and sharing something new with people. And white Bordeaux has become that kind of cult, little known wine against the sea of red wine that's made here. Pessac-Léognan, I think, again, it's only 30 years old, so it's easy for us to say, oh, they're the established players. But really, it's because the group of white wines there, the Graves whites that are now our Pessac-Léognan, had been making wine for many centuries and have a wonderful reputation, and rightly have a wonderful reputation. The biggest difference with Pessac-Léognan whites and the whites in Entre-deux-Mers, which is the biggest producer of white wines, is that Pessac uses barrel aging. So you tend to get a more structured feel to your white wine. It will age a little better. The Entre-deux-Mers whites are all about keep it fresh, keep it fruity, drink it young. So it's a very different style. And there's definitely room for both of them. The icon wines in the Médoc, the icon whites in the Médoc, tend to go more with that Pessac-Léognan style, where they'll be using barrels and trying to have a slightly more gourmet expression of the whites. Another difference between the two would be that Pessac and the Médoc will tend to be a mix between Sémillon and Sauvignon Blanc. And over in Entre-deux-Mers, more and more, that this has changed recently, but more and more they will put their emphasis really on Sauvignon Blanc because they want it to be fresh, easy, not expensive, and, you know, whack it out in the year or two after vintage.
That's fascinating. And I had no idea, actually, about that past for Castillon-Lestrac. Very interesting. Now, we're heading rapidly like an express train towards en primeur season, as you'll be only too well aware, Jane. And, well, for the last 20 years at least, people have been saying, oh, it's an anachronism, it can't last, why do they do it, they're addicted to it, why do they bother? But it still does last, it has lasted. So why is that? Why does Bordeaux need en primeur in a way that other regions don't seem to, given that there's so much wine available anyway?
It does seem crazy. I laughed this year as the Oscars were coming up, because there were a ton of articles in magazines and newspapers saying, that's it, the Oscars are finished, you know, with all the Me Too and all of the problems that they've had, and last year with the wrong, announcing the wrong winners and all the rest of it, they said, that's it, the Oscars are done. And it just really made me laugh, because as you say, every single year you have the same thing saying, en primeur, it's finished, it's not going to work. I would say, for a start, as we all know, it isn't the whole of Bordeaux that is sold this way. It's 250 to 300 chateaus that are sold as futures. But they have a very, very, very big psychological impact on how the whole of Bordeaux is sold. One of the reasons is that there's just so much wine here. This is the biggest quality wine region in France, as in Appellation Contrôlée region in France, and they make a ton of wine which needs to go out. About 60% of Bordeaux wine is sold in France, and most of that is through supermarkets. So while we may not realize, I'm completely guilty of this myself, we think about these very top, maybe 50 labels that are sold to collectors and are sold to Hong Kong and China, etc. But there are vast numbers, fifth gross, fourth gross, the Saint-Emilion Grand Crus, Saint-Emilion Grand Cru Classes, but not up to the premier level, which gets sold into supermarkets. And the people who are buying it, the supermarket buyers, don't want to be constantly going to different estates and to be tasting and buying. They want an easy way to do it. So there is still a demand at a basic level from big buyers in France, in Belgium, a lot of it goes to Belgium, in Germany, to buy in this way. So there is a place for en primeur still, but you're quite right that it is changing. And it's getting complicated because the main chateaus, the top chateaus, are wanting to keep back more. They obviously are kind of one foot in, one foot out. They don't quite know what they want to do with it. It's an evolving system. But at its heart, the reason that it works, the reason it survives, is simply because of the volume of wine that Bordeaux makes. And it's the most efficient mechanism to get that wine to market.
Mm. One foot in, one foot out, that's true. And of course, Latour has taken both feet out. It's pulled out of the system altogether. Are there any signs that anybody else is going to follow their lead?
Well, I was looking at this the other day because Latour has just announced that the 2012 Fort de Latour will be sold at the end of this month. And this will be the very first wine under their new system since they have stepped back out of en primeur. So up until this point, it's been kind of speculation. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Will people care? Will they possibly be able to keep the same price? Because one of the things about en primeur is it gets a buzz going. Like any kind of bring and buy sale and auction, when you feel the pressure, the chateaus release the wines for 2 or 3 days and then they close and they say, if you haven't bought then, you don't get it. There's a pressure. So that hasn't been the case for Latour till now, because they've released wines which has already been on the market. So sorry, just to be clear, they have still released wines. They just haven't released new, young wines. They haven't released in the en primeur system, but they have released older vintages. This will be the first vintage that they release, which they also didn't release en primeur. So they stepped back in 2011, and this is the 2012 vintage. So from here, we're going to start seeing what will the effect actually be on the market. And I am absolutely certain that if it works, this is when we will start seeing other chateaus pulling out. They weren't the first to pull back, by the way. About 10 years before, or maybe 6 years before, André Lourton was selling Chateau La Louvière en primeur, and he pulled that back out because he didn't feel it was the right way for that to go. One of the reasons is because there was a supermarket war, price war happened in France. And so La Louvière was available in, I can't remember which one, say Leclerc at one price. And what happened was they kept lowering their prices and it drove the Chateau mad. And they said, right, we're taking it off this system. So I think we're going to have a very interesting next 12 months, 24 months, as we start to see if Le Tour works, yes, other people will follow. And that this is what I mean by they're keeping one foot in, one foot out, because they've started keeping a little bit more wine back at the Chateau just in case, as far as I can tell, they want to follow Le Tour.
Of course, the other thing about Enprimeur is you had this great community of merchants in Bordeaux, La Place de Bordeaux, as it's called, who actually have to absorb a fairly high percentage of what the Chateau put out every year if they want to be assured of allocations in future years. So in difficult years, like, well, famously 2013, but there have been a fair few semi-difficult years recently, the Place de Bordeaux, the merchants have to finance a lot of the stock carrying, don't they? Tell us a little bit more about that and let us know if, I mean, is all of this in good shape, or are the merchants beginning to puff and shout a bit that, you know, the Chateau are leaning too heavily on them?
So you bring up a really great point, which I think is quite often misunderstood about this system of selling. From the outside, we observe these high prices and we think, okay, the Chateaus, we know, will be making a lot of profit. And we assume as well, these négociants, all they're doing is basically taking a load of Enprimeur wine, selling it on to their clients and taking the profit. This is the assumption. But in fact, what happens is to get those, say, 100 cases at Enprimeur, every single négociant, say most Chateaus would probably split between 40 to 50 négociants approximately. That's how many they would use. Not everyone, but that's a pretty good rule of thumb. Each one of those négociants during the year will be buying back vintages. They will be, you know, having to host lots of dinners, having to do lots of PR for the Chateaus. Remember, this is unpaid because they don't get directly paid by the Chateaus. They get paid on the profit that they're making from selling. But it is no longer the case that it is an easy sell by any stretch of the imagination to sell Enprimeur, because the Chateaus are taking a lot more profit themselves than they did historically. Maybe 15, 20 years ago, it was pretty much understood that the Chateaus would take, of course, they would take a good percentage for themselves, but they would leave quite a bit on the table for the négociants and for the end merchants in London or San Francisco or wherever. And that slice of the pie has become harder. So what we've found in Bordeaux over the last couple of years is that you see a lot of merchants being sold, being amalgamated into bigger companies, because you need extremely deep pockets to be a négociant. And it can be very profitable, but it tends to be, you've got to be in it for the long run. You've got to think of your profits being over 20, 30 years plus, because particularly with how it is now, that there is less margin to be taken. It's simply in the Enprimeur game.
That's absolutely fascinating. Gosh, there's so much more I'd like to ask you, Jane. But of course, I'm sure you'll be covering it all in the course that's going to be launched, the master level course. So I'm going to look forward to hooking into some of that, I hope. But there is one little question I have to come to you right with at the end. And that is our favourite little question for these podcasts. If you were a wine, which wine would you be, and tell us why?
Okay, so I'm so sorry. All I did was I went online and did a quiz of what grape variety are you? And I had to pick one that was in Bordeaux because I thought, okay, this is where I am and this is what I'm going to be teaching about. So the quiz told me that I was Sauvignon Blanc because I was well-traveled and because I was open and creative. So that was the grape variety I chose.
Okay, well, are you a dry wine or are you a nobly rotted wine, Sauvignon Blanc?
Good question. I think dry. And relatively low in alcohol.
Fantastic.
I think that's fantastic, too. I think that's a great answer. Thank you so much. Jane, just real quick, one more question before we let you go. With respect to that master level course on Bordeaux, what can we look forward to?
It really is a brilliant lineup, mainly because of the people that you have who are going to be teaching, which is Not me by any stretch of the imagination. I'm going to be doing six of the classes, but the other people that we have are really incredible. We have a really great young sommelier in Bordeaux who's called Alex Morin, who was a classmate of mine when I did the tasting diploma at the Institute of Enology here, and he's just a brilliant guy. And he's going to be talking about food and wine matching Bordeaux wines in restaurants. How are they evolving? Again, this idea that a lot of sommeliers turned away from Bordeaux, how do we get them back in? And we're seeing that migration back. So he's going to talk a lot about that. We have Sandra Dubosc, who is an enologist who consults for over 50 chateaus across Bordeaux. She will be talking a lot about the viticulture of the region, how that is evolving. I've talked quite a bit about terroir, well, just today while we've been talking. And it's one of the areas which I think is most exciting right now in Bordeaux, because for so many years, it's been brands, money, the star appellations. That has been the dialogue that has driven Bordeaux. And it really needs to change, and it is starting to change. So I will be talking about terroir within the course, and so will Sandra, and talking about how the chateaus are adapting, how they are changing their rootstocks, or changing their grape varieties, or changing all kinds of just small, subtle things that they're doing to maximize these incredible soils they have here. We have Suzanne Mustasic, who is an author, a really smart, smart journalist who wrote a brilliant book about China and Bordeaux called Thirsty Dragon. She's going to be talking about the business of Bordeaux, about the négociant system. She's very, very knowledgeable, smart woman. Fiona Morrison from Le Pan, who few people know Pomerol and really Bordeaux better than her. So it's going to be a really wonderful overview of bringing true experts together about Bordeaux.
That sounds like it's going to be a very comprehensive and enjoyable course. So thank you so much for filling us in on that. Thank you both for being here today. And listeners, you can find out more information about the upcoming Bordeaux Master Level course with Jane, Andrew, and other French wine information on the website at wineschoolguild.org.